You're listening to Groundwire, grassroots news coverage from coast to coast to coast.
This kind of a not in my backyard mentality is one that just has to be removed altogether.
Today, April 5th, 2012, is officially known as Kamloops LGBTQ Day of Pride!
I've never actually known the station without Chad as the station manager. That there's something to live up to there.
They're just fracturing any kind of a logical system that could address any of these issues in a cohesive way.
In this edition of Groundwire, Catherine Fisher in Nelson, BC, speaks with SANAIC spokesperson Marilyn James about the federal government's proposed changes to the Fisheries Act.
Carly Forbes reports from CFRU in Guelph on the Ontario Court of Appeal decision regarding the criminalization of sex work in Ontario.
We have a report on the notice of a civil claim filed by Taseko Mines Limited, alleging the Western Canada Wilderness Committee made inaccurate and defamatory comments concerning Taseko's proposed New Prosperity gold-copper project at Fish Lake.
We also have an interview with Sadar Saadi of No One Is Illegal Toronto about the recent actions organized on Refugee Rights Day on April 4th.
And on the Community Radio report, we have a profile of Mike Atkinson, the new station manager at CJSW-FM in Calgary, Alberta.
Here are the headlines.
We are excited, beyond excited really, to tell you that today, April 5th, 2012, is officially known as Kamloops LGBTQ Day of Pride!
The city of Kamloops, BC hosted its first Pride Parade on April 5th, 2012. Caitlin Scorer, a member of the Thompson Rivers University Pride Club, and one of the parade organizers, spoke with Catherine Fisher of Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, BC about how things came together.
Myself and my partner in the event, we facilitated it, but the entire community, both on campus and off campus, was ready for this type of event. So when we did put it out on the internet and when we started to speak about it to media outlets, everybody who'd been kind of waiting for this moment jumped on board. We had made a little Facebook group and it had gone viral overnight and it had gained monumental support within 24 hours. And so it started as a little event that we thought we'd have our friends marching with us and became an event filled with hundreds and hundreds of people marching together.
Kamloops is a city in interior BC with a population of about 90,000 people. This year, the Pride Parade received the full support of Kamloops Mayor and Council. This is in contrast to an attempt to declare a Pride Day in 2007, when the same request was voted down by a previous city council and a sitting city councillor publicly likened homosexuality to a disease. Scorer and the other Pride organizers were delighted with how the 2012 parade went off.
It's incredible. It's always been here and now we're getting to show it, so we couldn't be happier.
The Government of Canada's job numbers for the month of March signaled improvement for most of Canada. The country added 10,500 jobs in total. Manitoba gained 6,100, Saskatchewan added 300, and Alberta added 4,400. But the news was not so positive for BC. Economists say the province lost 1,700 jobs from February. And according to the figures, the trend in BC is away from full-time work and towards part-time work. The province lost 8,900 full-time jobs and added 7,200 part-time jobs. In a press conference the day after the numbers were released, BC's Premier, Christy Clark, touted her new jobs plan and stressed the importance of taking a long-term view on such figures.
If you look at it over the last year, and really statisticians look at these things, and our Ministry of Finance looks at these things over the longer term, 38,000 net new jobs created in British Columbia over the last year. And we are in tough economic times here in the world. So, you know, those are the numbers I think that really matter. I think you'll see it go up and down. Some months you've seen it go up 8,000 jobs, but you really need to look at it over the longer term.
Reporting for Groundwire, I'm Joel Bard.
And now it's time for our feature stories.
On April 4th, Refugee Rights Day, refugee and immigrant activists, including No One Is Illegal, occupied Conservative MP offices in Ottawa, Toronto, St. Catharines, Edmonton, and Vancouver Coast Salish territories. Banners were also dropped in Montreal, Vancouver, and Halifax. John Bonar interviewed Sardar Sadi, a member of No One Is Illegal Toronto, for Rabble.ca, while inside the office of MP Ted Opitz.
Today is Refugee Rights Day, and as I understand it, refugee and immigrant rights activists are occupying five Conservative MPs' offices across the country, as well as there are banner drops in a couple of cities as well. Why is this all going on?
I'm a refugee myself. I come to Canada as a refugee. I have permanent residency, but with this bill, C-31, I'm afraid of my permanent residency even be revoked or denied. So we are here occupying, No One Is Illegal Toronto, occupying just office. It's simultaneously happening with five cities across Canada in three provinces. And we have started the campaign, and we are not going to stop until we shut down this Bill C-31 and we oppose it.
What are your main objections to Bill C-31?
Well, Bill C-31 basically slams the door on refugees and jails, asylum seekers, and it's based on three mandates. It's the mandate discrimination on nationality basis, criteria, jails refugees, and it revokes and denies permanency from permanent residents.
Now, you're a refugee yourself, and you're saying that if Bill C-31 had been in place when you had applied for refugee status, that you would never have qualified. Why is that?
Definitely. I'm right now, I even have permanent residency. I'm afraid of that. And I know many people, there are many refugees living in this country in a very terrible situation, in a very hard circumstances. And this bill is definitely worse than their situation, and we are basically afraid of this bill and afraid of this new immigration system that Mr. Jason Kenney is proposing on Canadian people.
And tell me what's been going on here in Toronto today to oppose Bill C-31.
So here today, Are actually currently occupying Mr. Ted Obey's office. We are occupying his office, and we demand an immediate stop on this bill. And we have been writing letters and calling MPs and Jason Kenney, but unfortunately, we haven't received any response. So we'll continue until we stop this and shut down this bill.
Bill C-31 is currently in its second reading. Jason Kenney has stated that he wants the bill passed before June 2012. Thanks to Rabble.ca, John Bonner, and Carly Forbes. The Ontario Court of Appeal recently released its decision regarding the charter challenge in the Bedford case. Here are the reactions of sex workers and activists involved in the case.
On Monday, March 26th, a five-judge panel from the Ontario Court of Appeal came back with its decision regarding the criminalization of sex work in Ontario. I spoke with Fred Chatbot, a member of POWER, an Ottawa-based sex worker organization, about the ruling.
Everyone at POWER was quite nervous to know if the Himmel decision was going to be upheld by the Court of Appeal, because the Himmel decision was pretty perfect in the way that it addressed how the prostitution laws altogether have an impact on how sex workers can be made vulnerable to violence. So when the ruling came in on Monday, I have to say my reaction, and it's shared by all of the power board that was present when it came in, was being deflated. The ruling was not what we were hoping for in terms of the fight for the decriminalization of sex work in Canada.
Fred went on to deconstruct the ruling, starting with the Common Body House Law, which criminalizes keeping a place to work from.
if we take apart what exactly happened is that, in fact, the body house provision was not struck down. It was the judges recommended unanimously that the government, so the Harper government at the present, to come up with a new legislation that would regulate body houses in Canada. So basically they gave the government 12 months to come up with a new law. So really, starting Monday, nothing really changed. They just opened the door for Parliament to regulate body houses.
Three of the five judges ruled that the laws criminalizing communicating for the purposes of sex work should be upheld. However, two of the judges from this panel dissented. I spoke with Amy Lebovich, a current sex worker and member of Sex Professionals of Canada, who is one of the plaintiffs in this charter challenge, about why the communication provision was upheld. I also spoke with Keisha Scott from Maggie's Toronto, an organization by and for sex workers, about who the communicating law affects the most.
It's the court sending a clear message with keeping that law. They've even said in their document, their decision, which is like 146 pages, so it was very long. But parts that I got out from that was basically the public nuisance is more important to deal with than sex workers' safety, is what they've done with keeping the communicating law.
An amendment was made to the living off the avails provision so that it only criminalizes the exploitation of sex workers. However, exploitation has yet to be defined, and there are already laws that criminalize exploitive labor in Canada.
The communicating law definitely impacts sex workers that are on the street levels, and we know that largely those workers are Indigenous, racialized, trans workers, and other workers that are living on the margins in different ways. So that takes away the right for sex workers to just negotiate with clients as far as what they are offering, their prices, and ultimately things that will allow them to work in a way that's comfortable and safe. I know that the connection to it has been about social nuisance or public nuisance, and that people are witnessing the transaction between two people, or they are actually in some cases possibly seeing the actual sex acts occurring. Well, we know that that's not likely the truth. I mean, two people that are speaking to each other on the street could be speaking about anything, like, and suggesting that a good neighborhood is one without sex workers entirely. And you can speak to many people that live in certain neighborhoods where there are strolls. People will say, you know, I felt good coming home because there were sex workers on the street. It meant that everything was as it should be. Everything was fine. And, you know, I had a great relationship with many of the girls that lived on my block. There weren't any problems. So this kind of not-in-my-backyard mentality is one that just has to be removed altogether.
Amy Lebovich also commented on this part of the ruling.
The living off the avails law, the positive side to it is we'll be able to, you know, to have bodyguards and receptionists and security and that sort of thing. But because they didn't strike the law completely, and they just made that amendment, there's a concern, I guess, that how are they going to prove exploitation, right? How is that going to look, right?
Overall, this ruling comes as a great disappointment to many sex workers. I'm Carly Forbes, reporting for Groundwire from CFRU in Guelph, Ontario.
Brand new city in a city by highways and dumps, homeless and hungry, nobody got money, make you want to scream and shout about a brand new city in a city. Won't you scream and shout, there's a brand new nation, jail plantations growing by leaps and bounds. Well, it's all around the globe.
That was Brand New City by Faith Nolan. You're listening to Groundwire, community radio news from coast to coast to coast. Now to a story that Groundwire has been following since 2010, the proposed mine development at Testanbini, or Fish Lake. Environmental group the Western Canada Wilderness Committee was served March 1st with a notice of civil claim by Vancouver-based Taseko Mines Limited. Taseko filed the notice in BC Supreme Court, alleging that the Wilderness Committee made inaccurate and defamatory statements concerning Taseko's proposed New Prosperity Gold Copper project, and that these comments might mislead the public. Russell Hallbauer, CEO of Taseko, said in a news release that Taseko welcomes a full, thorough, and open process to evaluate the merits of the New Prosperity project. We cannot, however, stand idly by when certain parties, such as the Western Canada Wilderness Committee, mislead the public. Joe Foy, who is the National Campaign Director for the Wilderness Committee, calls the legal action a slap lawsuit designed to silence criticism. In a news release, the committee expressed concern that this court action stifles fair comment about Taseko's environmentally risky mine proposal and that people should be able to enjoy full participation in the federal environmental review process, including the right to comment, without fear of time-consuming and costly litigation. In a press release sent out March 5th, the Tlilcotin National Government expressed shock about the notice of claim against the Wilderness Committee, and Huniqutin Chief Marilyn Batiste commented, "If it is libelous to dispute unproven claims and present alternative views, then what is the point of having public hearings?" Lorraine Chisholm of Vancouver Co-op Radio's Red Eye Collective spoke with Joe Foy of the Wilderness Committee recently about the defamation suit.
Their defamation suit lists a number of things. They take issue with us saying that Little Fish Lake and their New Prosperity mine proposal would be turned into a toxic waste pond, for instance. In fact, what Taseko proposes to do is actually drown the valley that Little Fish Lake is in, and inundate Little Fish Lake and the surrounding land in a toxic tailings pond. And they define that as proof that they don't want to turn Little Fish Lake into a toxic tailings pond.
The Western Canada Wilderness Committee's lawyer filed a response to civil claim on March 22nd, stating that the committee believes that the defamation action is without merit. Foy says that the Wilderness Committee wants to get their day in court as soon as possible.
What happens next is the Wilderness Committee pushes to have this get before a judge. And the reason is what companies will often do is try and delay and delay and sort of keep this cloud hanging over top. And we believe that it's in the best interests of everyone that this matter be decided as quickly as possible, because this very important issue is moving through the process, and you don't want this hanging over people who are considering, should I speak up or not? What can I say? What can't I say? Am I going to get a letter in the mail? We would like to see this matter cleared up as quickly as possible.
Thanks to the Red Eye Collective for files.
Internal documents leaked in March indicate that the federal government is planning to change the Canadian Fisheries Act, specifically by removing the provision requiring protection of habitat. Many scientists are concerned that changes to the act will severely impair Canada's ability to protect biodiversity and species at risk. Marilyn James, the appointed spokesperson of Saniks Nation, is also concerned about fish habitat and species at risk, but she believes that, while the proposed changes may further compromise the health and habitat of fish, the act is already ineffective and flawed. She believes that a completely new approach is required to preserve the fish that remain in our rivers, oceans, and streams.
The leaked proposed changes to the Fisheries Act have been in the news a lot lately. A number of news sources have referred to the act as the best and most clearly worded piece of environmental legislation in Canada. Many eminent scientists are concerned about the federal government's plan to remove habitat protection from Section 35 of the act, and Fisheries Minister Keith Ashfield says the government is reviewing fish and fish habitat protection policies to ensure that they do not go beyond their intended conservation goals. While weakening the act, will clearly have a negative impact on fish and aquatic ecosystems. Is the existing act actually doing a good job? Marilyn James, appointed spokesperson of Senaikes Nation in Interior BC, says the Senaikes don't think so.
Some of the fisheries solutions or strategies that they're engaged in right now are really neglectful, criminally neglectful, and their responses to threatened and endangered species have been morally corrupted. And in that regard, I'm speaking of the sturgeon enhancement program on the Columbia River that has an extremely high mortality rate. They make thousands and thousands of hatchery sturgeon. They do nothing to protect the habitat. They do nothing to extend the habitat. So the survivability of those sturgeon are next to nothing.
Marilyn James spoke about what should be considered in any legislation that would effectively protect fish and fish habitat.
I think that the Fisheries Act needs to consider hardcore management strategies around habitat and habitat restoration. And I think until those issues are solved, they should not be allowing for any development that compromises the fisheries that exist now. I think extensive studies should be done, not just to the big species in a water system, but to the smallest species in the water system, and that the management strategies should revolve around those small species in the water system. If they're doing fine, the larger species are going to do fine. And I think their strategies around introduction of different species into different water systems all have to be suspended. And, of course, ideas like fracking have got to be completely taken out of any kind of development.
This is Catherine Fisher from Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, reporting for Groundwire.
And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report.
Our Community Radio Report features Mike Atkinson, the new station manager at CJSW in Calgary, Alberta. Mike started at CJSW 11 years ago as a programmer. He's also served on the station executive, and he was the music director for 3 years. Long-serving CJSW station manager Chad Saunders resigned from his position in February, and in March, Mike was hired. Groundwire spoke a bit with Mike about his history at CJSW and how he first got involved.
When I started at the station, we were still in our basement studios. So a couple years ago, we moved up onto the third floor here, but back then we were in a basement bunker, no windows, no nothing. And I was in my orientation for my first year of university, and I went to the Gauntlet, which is the newspaper here on campus. I kind of signed up to volunteer, but didn't really hang out or anything. I ended up still doing some stuff with them over the years, but kind of walked out the door, and then I went downstairs to CGSW, and they invited me to eat lunch on the couch, hang out, and even that first day, I was just reading a little news report on the air. So it felt very welcoming, and ever since that day, it was just like, basically the couch was always open for me to eat lunch, and the airwaves became available to me as I worked through and did my volunteer time. So it was a very welcoming environment.
We also spoke a bit about how the new job's been going.
I'm pretty excited. It's great to be able to work with all of the, like, the membership of CJSW it's home. It was a home for me for 3 years. It's been home really for all 10 years. The entire time I was doing my university degree, this was home. And then, as I was working here as the music director, and it just feels good to get back in amongst all these great people. And it's good times. It's sad to see. I mean, I've never actually known the station without Chad as the station manager. So there's definitely, you know. There's something to live up to there, for sure. But I'm excited. I'm excited about it.
Mike also spoke about the station's upcoming plans to apply for power increase.
The next big thing for CGSW, the Calgary radio market has been exploding a little bit over the last couple of years. They've been giving away quite a few licenses. We're actually getting to the point where we're going to have a totally full dial in the next little bit. So when I first started the station, we were, I think, a 100-watt station. And since then, we've bumped ourselves up to a 4,000-watt station. But the next big thing for us is to get another tower wattage increase. We're hoping to maybe get up to about 20,000 watts. And I think that two things. Now that the radio market will be totally saturated and there won't be new stations coming on, that will help with stability. But also just more wattage will help us be more listenable on, you know, bedside radio, Walkmans. It doesn't matter. You should be able to pick up the station anywhere as long as you're in town.
This is Catherine Fisher reporting for Groundwire. That was Jay Crocker with a short excerpt from Somewhere Between Good and Evil.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Annika Roche.
And I'm Catherine Fisher. This episode of Groundwire was created on Sinaik's traditional territory at Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, BC. Music in this episode was by Faith Nolan and Jay Crocker, with incidental music by Buffy St. Marie, Rylan Kewen, and Bismuth.
Headlines this week were written by Joel Bard and Catherine Fisher, with files from Deb O'Rourke and the Toronto Media Co-op.
Features were contributed by Carly Forbes and Catherine Fisher. Thanks as well to the Red Eye Collective, John Bonar, Ravel.ca, and Mary Carl Guillaume.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download at groundwire.ncra.ca.
We close today with a bit of Buffy St. Marie. This is her working for the government. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. If you'd like to become a contributor, please check out our guidelines at groundwire.ncra.ca.